This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Hour 2 of Tiki and Tierney here on CBS Sports Radio. I'm Tiki Barber coming to you live from the Quicken Loans Studio. National mortgage lender, Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully. Mortgage confidently. Good first hour we just had on the show. David Shaw, Stanford Cardinal head man, hopped in for a little bit. Did inbounds and out of bounds. But now we're going to get to a friend of our show, a friend of mine, Jeff Perlman, who's author of a new book, Football for a Buck, which is about the USFL. Jeff, thanks for hopping in for a couple of segments here with me. How you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks.
Now tell me about why you wanted to do this book on the USFL. There's so many things you could have written about. You're a journalist. You cover so many different things. Why the USFL?
First of all, I'll give you some good advice. Okay. If in the future you write a book, don't have it come out the same day as Bob Woodward's book. never goes well.
Hey, some diversity, man. Yeah. It's like, it's life. It's sports, and then it's also, you know, politics. Yeah. It's all good.
So I grew up in Mayo Pack, New York, and I love the USFL. And when I was a kid...
Wait, you loved the USFL?
Love.
Why did you love the USFL?
Because you know when you're a kid and things just seem like super big? Mm-hmm. Like you become an adult and you see behind the curtain a little bit in this business.
Of course.
When you're a kid, everything seems huge. And I remember being a kid, 10 years old, and Herschel Walker's on the cover of Sports Illustrated in a general's uniform. And it's perfectly white and red, and it says, hitting pay dirt. And you open up, and it's the USFL helmets. And they're just freaking badass. They're like the Michigan Panthers. And the, you know, the New Jersey Generals and the Stars, and it's, the colors are like champagne.
Yeah.
Not, you know, not beige, champagne and like bursting. It was just electric.
Wait,
to me.
So did you have a love for the NFL also, or was it?
I was a big Jets fan.
Or this replaced the NFL? Oh, wait, you're a Jets fan?
I was.
That explains it.
Yeah,
there's my answer.
What can I tell you?
I get it.
Freeman McNeil, man.
But the NFL was also big in the 80s.
The USFL just struck me as like new and revolutionary and really cool.
Yeah.
And Herschel Walker, people don't, like, at the time, you probably remember, like, Herschel Walker wasn't just another Heisman winner.
Oh, he was the man. He came to Roanoke. I told you the story off air. When I was, I was 8 years old. He came to Roanoke and went to a sporting goods store. And me and my brother were like, Mom, we got to go see Herschel Walker. And we had the poster forever of Herschel.
He was like Bo Jackson before Bo Jackson.
Exactly right. He was larger than life.
Right.
And physically, he's huge. And interestingly, I ended up playing against him when I got to the National Football
League. He played until he was 97 years old.
He played forever. But he was the... He was a Heisman Trophy winner who chose the NFL, or chose the USFL, other than the NFL. Why were guys doing that back then?
Well, he was interesting. He was the first guy. And basically, he was a junior. He won the Heisman his junior year. Came from a very poor family in Wrightsville, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to play pro football. And the NFL wasn't taking guys. And they only took seniors at that point.
Interesting.
His agent called the USFL one day and said, listen, Herschel Walker wants to come out and he wants to play for you guys. And the number two guy at the USFL used to be a player agent named Steve Earhart. And he's like, I'm not talking to you, because you weren't allowed to do that at the time. And then in the office, they were like, well, why can't we do this? Like, why can't we bring him in?
Yeah.
So he was a revolutionary sort of first guy. And then they had the 83 draft. And the NFL never took the USFL seriously at the beginning.
Of course.
It was is it? Right. Then they have the draft. They draft Craig James out of SMU.
Mm-hmm.
He signs. Tim Spencer out of Ohio State. He signs. You know, like one guy after another, and they signed all these big names, and all of a sudden the NFL, which joked, they would call the USFL the useless in their office. That was their nickname.
Wow.
They were like, oh, crap. And when Herschel signed, it was like a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. So why were those guys choosing the USFL at the time?
Money.
Money.
They were
paying more than the NFL.
Yeah, they were getting big money to jump to the league. And it's funny, like Craig James is a great example. You remember Craig James?
Yeah, of course.
Right, really good running back. Eric Dickerson's back for me.
Yep, they called the death penalty down there, right?
Yeah, they sure did. Yeah, it's true. And so he came out, and it's actually very funny. He came out of SMU, Washington Federals drafted him, and they had a GM named Dick Myers who had been Bobby Beathard's assistant, and he was just a numbers guy, but the Federals hired him as their GM. And they go down to Texas and they negotiate this deal, and they fly back for the press conference. And Craig James's agent, who I think was one of the boosters at SMU.
Oh, of course. I mean,
has the GM in the room in Washington. The media is in the other room, like drinking sodas. And he's like, we want 100,000 more.
Oh, wow.
And like, the GM is like, no, I can't do that. He's like, well, we're going to leave. All right, maybe I can do that. And like, he ended up getting 100,000 more from the Washington Federals. They were just like, they were signing everyone. They were spreading money like crazy. And people were intrigued by it, you know?
We're talking to Jeff Perlman, author of Football for a Buck about the USFL. He's in studio here with us. Why did the USFL fail?
I mean, this is not a political statement, I just want to say. It really isn't. It's a football statement.
Okay.
Started in 1983, mm-hmm. had a good first season. The New Jersey Generals, my New Jersey Generals, were just for sale after the 83 season. The owner was from Oklahoma. He didn't want to keep it.
Yeah.
Donald Trump buys the team. He spends $10.5 million on a team that was actually selling for $8 million, but he thought other people were going to bid on it, so he overpaid for the Generals. But he gets them. In the lead-up to buying the team, he's all about spring football, and he's psyched about spring football. As soon as he gets a team, we need to move to fall. We have to move to fall immediately. Fall football is where it's at. We need to move to fall.
And compete, basically, with the NFL.
Yeah, but they were so not ready to do this. He has a secret meeting with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner. Trump pays for a suite at the Pierre, and Rozelle agrees to meet with him. And he says to Rozelle in this meeting, I don't really care about the USFL. I want to get in the NFL. What do I have to do? And Pete Rozelle says to him, as long as I'm involved in the NFL, as long as my family's involved in the NFL, you will have no place in this league.
Why? What was the animosity?
Because he saw him as a con man, and he saw him as a huckster, and he had tried buying. First of all, Donald Trump used to say all the time, I could have had an NFL team. I had a lot of offers to buy an NFL team. It's factually not true.
Yeah.
Like, not true. He made a very thin offer to buy the Colts in 1980 from the Irsay family. They never took it seriously. He just didn't trust him.
Yeah.
And so then after that happened, Trump was undeterred, and he kept leading the charge forward. And he convinced the other owners that there was a great TV deal waiting to be had in the fall, which was just not true. It was just not true.
Yeah.
And
so he was just lying.
He was lying.
Lying to get it to move, to be a competitor to the NFL.
He
thought that the USFL could win. He thought
he didn't care about the USFL. The USFL wasn't even a thing to him. It was a thing he was in. His whole goal was to get it. He had this plan. The Jets had just moved to Jersey with the Giants, to be with the Giants. Queens was open. His plan was Manhattan Stadium eventually. We move to Queens and we go to Manhattan. It could be the Generals. It could be another New York City team. I don't care as long as I get it.
Yeah.
The USFL, I mean, he
wanted it to be acquired. So he wanted this. He thought this would operate like a regular business deal. You bring in a competitor who is challenging, you know, your market share.
Yes.
Instead of going head-to-head, battling head-to-head with the NFL, they'll just acquire me.
Yes.
That was his business?
Yes. It was the dumbest freaking thing ever. Wow. And here's the crazy thing about it. And this is really crazy. The other owners, so there were teams in Houston, there were teams in Pittsburgh, Michigan, so NFL cities. The other owners believed him that they could get a fall TV deal. That would be great. They believed him.
Yeah.
And they voted to do it. They voted to move to the fall. And then they decided to sue the NFL. They were going to sue the NFL because the NFL was monopolizing TV and they were actually working to destroy the USFL. And they were 100% correct. Mm. They were actually right.
Yeah.
They held the lawsuit in New York City. Donald Trump hired Roy Cohn, an infamous attorney for the McCarthyism era. He told the other owners, as soon as I hire Roy Cohn, the NFL is going to want to settle. I guarantee you the NFL is going to settle.
Yeah.
Guarantee.
Yeah, acquire us and we have NFL teams.
The NFL did not settle. In fact, Paul Tagliabue, who's not the commissioner but was a high-ranking official, stood up in a meeting of petrified NFL owners and said, if we give in here, every time a new league comes along, they're going to know we have a weakness. They're going to go for our knees. We cannot give in here. The NFL, it went to trial in Manhattan in 1986.
I don't know the story.
It's this crazy story.
Fascinating.
Went to trial. It was an amazing trial, really was. And, or as Trump would say, the biggest trial ever. The USFL was supposed to call all these witnesses. They decided not to. They made Trump the star witness. It was Trump, a drunk Howard Cosell, and Al Davis testified on behalf of the USFL.
Wow.
Donald Trump, the NFL attorney, made Donald Trump their own star. He was like, I found my villain. He was bombastic. He was arrogant. It was the worst testimony anyone had ever seen. I talked to one of the jurors who said, a woman who was on the jury, she said he was trying to stare down the jury members and intimidate them. She had this vivid memory of him just staring them down, trying to intimidate them. It comes, what the jury decides, which is crazy. They decide, you know what? You are correct. The NFL has colluded against you. The NFL has monopolized fall TV. But ultimately, you guys are a bunch of idiots for trying to move to fall. You win. So wait, I just want to say, it's like Chuck Fucina. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
He was the
Philadelphia
idea.
Stars quarterback.
Okay.
Second to the Heisman Trophy in 78 to Billy Sims. He's taking a master's degree class at Penn State, and he's sitting in this class, and the teacher stops the class and says, Chuck, you're not going to believe this. you guys just won.
So
he's like, I got to call my wife.
USFL won in court against the NFL as they were trying to collude and push them out of the market.
So UFL won.
The USFL won
the court case.
Okay.
Pete Rozelle was late to court. He's driving. He hears on the radio, the USFL just won his case. Oh, my God. What the hell? Oh, my God. You know, he's like having this panic. Then they find out how much they won. What the jury decided is you guys are all right, but you shot yourselves in the foot with your stupid decisions and moving to fall when you shouldn't have. And they gave him a dollar.
Wow.
Tripled to three under antitrust laws.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Wow. Jeff Perlman, a football for a buck. This story, and I'm sure many more in the National Football League. Just as an opinion from you now, is this why Trump hates the NFL now?
Oh. He tried buying the Colts, failed. He tried meeting with Rozelle to get a team, failed. He tried suing the NFL, failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills, failed. He made a weak effort to buy the Cowboys, failed. When he was an owner in the USFL, again, this is not political. It really isn't. When he was an owner in the USFL, he would do business while the national anthem was playing. Mm. He'd be on his phone. He'd be doing interviews. Guys talked about this.
Yeah.
It was never about patriotism. It was about a league that he wanted to be the club of. It was old money. Oh, I just got to say one thing. He's sitting next to John Mara during the trial at the end when it's announced. John Mara opens up his jacket, pulls out his wallet, takes out a dollar and hands it to Trump.
That's pretty awesome. That's pretty awesome when you look at it that way. Now, there's other stories in this book, but just to compare the USFL to some of these new leagues that are starting now, the AAF, the American Alliance of Football, the XFL is coming back again. Are there lessons that we should learn or glean from the USFL's attempt to take on the NFL? Even though these leagues aren't necessarily taking on the NFL, but are there lessons that we should look at for these two new leagues that are about to start?
I think so. I think, number one, you can't go head-to-head with the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too much money. It's too much of a head start.
Yeah.
You can't do it. The USFL did something really smart that worked well. They would have a general draft, and then they would have regional drafts. So, like, the Tampa Bay Bandits were signed. Florida, Florida State, Bethune-Cookman. So, presumably, you or I grow up loving... We watch Broward County High School football. Then our favorite player goes on to play at Florida. We're loyalists already.
Yes.
I think it's really smart. I also think spring football is smart. It's a smart season. You're not going head-to-head. The one thing I think that these leagues would be wise to do, though, if the New York Giants come along and they want to sign Omaha's quarterback, like, you don't only let them, you celebrate it. You issue a press release on your behalf saying, look, you saw him here today, and now he's here.
Yeah, so it's almost like a clearinghouse like college is.
Don't you think?
I mean, of course, because it brings legitimacy.
Right.
If the NFL sees your players as viable to play in their league, then your league must have some value. You're going to stick around for another segment here. We're going to take a quick break and get back to Jeff Perlman of Football for a Buck here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. Many more interesting stories, including the most interesting person that Jeff has ever met. Greg Fields. You never heard of him? Neither have I, but he'll tell us. Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. CBS's toll-free line, 855-212-4227, is brought to you by Geico. Hey, everyone, here's a quick way that you could save money. Switch to Geico. Do you need homeowners, renters, or motorcycle insurance, too? Get it all at geico.com. 420 Eastern, 120 Pacific. Here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio, we're joined in studio by Jeff Perlman, who wrote a book, Football for a Buck. We had the Trump story, and now you're going to tell me the story about why Greg Fields is the most interesting character in this book, someone who I literally have never heard of. Who
That's
is
awesome.
Greg Fields?
All right, I'd never heard of him either. Greg Fields, I had going in this book, I never heard of him. Greg Fields was a defensive lineman at Grambling. Played with like Doug Williams and Grambling back in the
day. All right.
1980, he's a rookie with the Baltimore Colts, plays 1 year, gets cut, goes to the Atlanta Falcons. They cut him in training camp, and he refuses to leave. He actually refuses to leave. They're like, Greg, you got to turn in your F you, I'm not leaving.
Yeah, yeah.
No, Greg, you really got to leave. No, I'm not leaving. They end up bringing an armed security guard to escort him away from the thing.
What year is this again?
80.
80, okay.
Okay, so that's kind of it for Greg Fields in the NFL. But the USFL comes along.
Mm-hmm.
1983, signs with the LA Express. He plays 1 year. Plays 2 years. His second year, though, 84, the new coach is a former NFL quarterback named John Hadle. And John Hadle decides, I need to cut Greg Fields. This isn't going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And the coaches
what was
are,
wrong with Greg Fields?
He just wasn't that good.
Yeah,
he was okay.
Okay.
And coaches are like, you may want to have someone in the room with you. He's like, nah, don't worry about it. The funny thing is, his best friend on the team, Greg Fields, was Nate Burleson's dad, Al Burleson.
Get out of here,
really?
He
was a defensive back with the LA Express.
Oh, we know Nate. We had him in last week.
Yeah, Nate's a great guy.
He's awesome.
Al got cut the day before, and Greg Fields was pissed because Al was his best friend on the team.
Oh, I got you.
So Greg Fields is telling people, if they cut me today, there's going to be civil war around here, I'm telling you. It's like, oh. All right. John Hader was like, I can handle this. He calls him in. He's like, listen, Greg. I mean, you've heard these. Listen, Greg, you've really been a great help here, but Greg Field stands up, punches Hato in the face, right? People come in, they're dragging him out.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to kill you. I'm going to kill you. Okay. He starts calling in death threats
wow.
to the coach and the defensive coordinator. He's like, I'm going to kill them, blah, blah, blah. Okay. They hire...
security, obviously.
Not only security. They hire a guy named Nelson Mercado, who is Liberace's bodyguard, who's based in Las Vegas working for Liberace. They're like, we really could use you here. He's from LA. He's like, okay, I'll come. He said Greg Fields... I interviewed Mercado for this. Greg Fields starts showing up at practices, like staring from behind the fences, staring him down. He's got a gun in the back. This guy Mercado put a tracker on his car, right? So Greg Fields is like calling in, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your
coach. Are you kidding?
No, I'm going to kill you. Okay.
I mean, I'm assuming this guy's in jail now, right?
Oh, it gets better. It's so good. Okay. And Nelson
I shouldn't
Mercado's
be
like,
laughing. But
no,
it's
but it's really good.
Funny.
Nelson Mercado, the Liberace bodyguard, is like, I can't believe this is my lot in life. I'm going to follow this guy. And then the gods of the USFL come. Everyone knows this is going on in USFL. It's been, but the San Antonio Gunslingers need defensive line help.
Oh,
so they actually call and sign Greg Fields. And when he reports to San Antonio, they all greet him dressed in helmets and pads as a joke, all the coaches.
Uh-huh.
And he's laughing. So he's in San Antonio and he's well behaved. Toward the end of the 85 season, the owner of the San Antonio Gunslingers stops paying players. You don't do that to Greg Fields, right? It's a really bad team. Their offices are in a trailer in the parking lot. They're using industrial spray paint to spray the yard markers. So, like, Steve Young has stories of sliding in San Antonio, and he's taking a shower later, and he has burn mixed with industrial spray paint.
Oh, lovely.
Screaming in the shower. It's
lovely.
Crazy. Their cheapest team in football. Greg Fields stops getting paid, and he's not happy. So one day he decides he's going to follow the owner home. And he puts a baseball bat in his car. And he follows Clint Mangus, the owner of the Gunslingers, home. And Mangus gets out of his car, and he sees Greg Fields standing there. And he walks over to him with a baseball bat. And he says, I see where you live. I know you have money. You better effing pay me now. And Clint Mangus goes, hold on. And he goes in his house. And he comes back with a bag, a paper bag filled with $10,000 in cash.
Get out of here.
I swear to God. Pays Greg Fields.
Did he cut him then?
No, then he was gone. He's like, are we good? And Greg Fields is like, yeah, man, we're good. And he leaves. Okay. I have two addresses for Greg Fields. That's it. But I need to find him.
Yeah.
I have nothing else.
This is as you're writing this book.
I'm writing this book.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I have
you
to
have
find
to
Greg Fields.
Yeah, you got to hear it from the horse's mouth.
But I have no one knows where he is. Like, Al Burleson doesn't know where he is. No one from Grambling knows where he is. Nobody knows. Everyone's like, he's crazy. Not winning Father of the Year points. I asked my son, Emmett, who's 9. You want to go find a football player? He's like, yeah, let's do it. We drove from Southern California to San Francisco to my two addresses. We spend the day walking around San Francisco, the really bad neighborhoods, and we finally get to Greg Fields. It's the one address, and there's a lockbox. It doesn't open. I have one more address. I leave Emmett with some friends. I go at night. It's a project to San Francisco. I knock on a window. Greg Fields' sister answers the door, and she says, yeah, I'm Greg's sister. And I'm like, my name's Jeff Perlman. I write books, blah, blah. She goes, I can give you his number, but he probably won't call. And I'm like, all right. 20 minutes later, I'm driving. Hey, this is Greg Fields. I'm like, oh, my God, Greg Fields. Nobody has ever been happier to talk to you. Long story short, the next day, me, my 9-year-old son, Greg Fields, sitting at a Cold Stone Creamery in a Sacramento food court at a mall talking about the USFL.
Oh, wow.
And Greg Fields telling me all the crazy stories about the USFL. And it was the greatest search and rescue assignment of my life and just joy.
Well, that's why he's interesting because what other crazy stories did he? I mean, what other things could he have told you other than how crazy he was?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. Like, I mean, there was the San Antonio Gunslingers. You've probably never experienced this in your career. They once put a guy in the injured list with a strained groin because he slammed his penis in a trunk.
What? How does that even happen?
I don't know. But he slammed his an equipment trunk, not a trunk of a car.
I mean, this book had to be so fun to write for you.
It's a joy.
I can't wait to read this. What's the
third craziest story?
No, like the biggest success story out of the USFL.
Well, four Hall of Famers.
Because a lot of these guys went on to play in the National Football League.
Four Hall of Famers. You got Steve Young, you got Jim Kelly, you have Gary Zimmerman, you have Reggie White. Jim Kelly, which is awesome, came out of Miami in that 83 quarterback class with Marino and Elway. He didn't want to go to Buffalo. He told the Bills, don't draft me. The Bills draft him. Him and his agent go. Because, you know, when you were playing, too, you didn't have options.
No.
You're either playing in the NFL or you're not playing.
Yeah, you weren't.
Right.
There's no freedom of movement.
So the USFL gave some freedom. So he goes to Buffalo and he's negotiating with his agent. And Bruce Allen, who's now with the Redskins, but yep. Bruce Allen was the general manager, 25 years old, of the Chicago Blitz, finds out they're in Buffalo. He calls, calls the Bills offices, pretends he's a relative of the agent, says, can you put Bob on the phone? He gets Bob. He's like, it's family emergency. Bob, it's Bruce Allen from the USFL. You know Jim doesn't want to play in Buffalo. I know he doesn't want to play in Buffalo. Get him out of there. We will make you happy. They leave. He says, we'll give you a choice where you want to play, and he signs with the Houston Gamblers.
Wow, nice, yeah. Nice. Steve Spurrier was also
a coach. A hated coach.
Why was he hated?
Players just found him obnoxious and kind of know-it-all.
And how did he become – I mean, he's one of the all-time great coaches at Florida. Yeah. Did he learn from his experience in the USFL how to be a great college coach as well?
He was an offensive coordinator at Duke, and they wanted to offer him the offensive coordinator job. And he said, I'll only come if you make me the head coach.
Yeah.
And what happened is it was the Tampa Bay Bandits, and Steve Spurrier at the time had a dog named Bandit, and the owner of the Bandits took it as an omen and signed him as a head coach.
I mean, it's wacky.
Like, it's crazy.
This league is wacky. Yes. And when you think about it in the business sense that the NFL has seemingly always operated with, how did this even last as long as it did?
Well, it was popular, and they had money,
yeah.
and they had great players. And they had a great idea. The idea itself of spring football is a good idea. It's not a bad idea, especially back then before the NFL was playing all the time and there was NFL Network. It was a good idea. They just blew it.
Yeah.
And they did some crazy. I mean, after the first season, the Chicago Blitz and the Arizona Wranglers were traded for each other. Like the entire teams were literally.
So they put one team.
The owner of the Chicago Blitz was a guy named Ted Dietrich.
There were no rules then.
Very few.
Yeah.
The owner of the Chicago Blitz lived in Arizona. And he was a doctor in Arizona. And he didn't like making the three-hour flight. There were 18 games in the season, 9 times on a chartered jet. He just didn't like that. So the league agreed to let them trade franchises. And here's the crazy thing. So all the Blitz players go to Arizona. And the Blitz were really good. So they become the Arizona Wranglers. The Arizona Wranglers are crap. They become the Chicago Blitz. The Chicago Blitz hire Marv Levy as coach, but don't tell him that he's inheriting a crap team, not a good team. And he takes over. The owner of the team was a guy named James Hoffman in Chicago. After 5 games, he's walking off the field with this guy, Dan Jiggetts, who played for the Bears. And he's like, yeah, Dan, I'm out of here. And Jiggetts is like, oh, where are you going this week? He goes, no, I quit. I'm not doing this anymore. And he just gave up the team. He literally just said, I'm done.
Yeah.
And the USFL had to take over the Chicago Blitz.
Oh, wow. Did they continue to stink, I'm sure?
Marv Levy had to bring in his own toilet paper.
Bring it from home. Right. Otherwise, you know what? You're out of luck.
Yeah.
You know what? Out of luck. When people read this, what do you hope they get out of it?
Joy. Yeah. Just fun and like what a great league it was and how fun it was.
Yeah, that's it sounds like it. I mean, just listening to your stories, it sounds like it's amazing. Jeff Perlman, the football for a book, The Crazy Rise and Even Crazier Demise. Oh, I see what you did there. Mm-hmm. Of the USFL. Jeff, appreciate you hopping in studio.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah,
I can't wait to read this.
When
I get a free weekend, I'm gonna dissolve it into my memory bank and bring up the stories later on.
Awesome.
Jeff, appreciate you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
What do we have on the other side here, Samter? We're doing a Triple G Canelo. Oh wait, that's right. The long sought after, at least year sought after, rematch of Triple G and Canelo. I'm gonna tell you why you shouldn't watch it. But before we get there, Richard Ackerman, can we get an update?
The injury report is brought to you by the Salt Institute. Let's take a look at the latest injuries. As we discussed the last hour, Chargers head coach Anthony Lynn confirmed earlier today that Joey Bosa will miss his second straight game with a foot injury, but added, quote, he's week to week, but he'll probably be gone for the next couple of weeks. Leonard Fournette of the Jacksonville Jaguars is also questionable in their week 2 meeting with the Patriots with a lingering hamstring issue. He did not practice yesterday. After exercise, it is critical to replace both water and salt lost through perspiration during activity. Salt is a vital component of hydration, and that's why athletes need it too. Find out more at alittlesalt.org. Tiki Barber here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. I know that because that's my problem with running marathons, Samter. I lose salt, and I end up cramping. We're going to get to Triple G and Canelo's fight that's coming up this weekend, this Saturday, I believe, on pay-per-view. But I saw this is a toss-off, I think, statement by Drew Brees talking about Baker Mayfield. Now, there's some comparisons between Drew Brees and Baker Mayfield. They both are really good at throwing the ball downfield. They are really good at very accurate throwers. They're both, I mean, Drew is what, 6'6", maybe he's 6'1". What do they list him as, 6'1"? Or so. Baker Mayfield is so they list him at 6 foot, not even 6'1". Baker is also, I think, 6 foot, even though he felt shorter when we met him. But the thing about Drew Brees is he plays tall. Right? I tell Brandon this all the time. You watch Drew, the way he throws, it's like he's always like reaching up his back to find space, and he throws well over top of linemen who are a few inches taller than him. Well, Baker Mayfield's the same way. Well, yesterday, I believe it was, Drew Brees, when talking about Baker Mayfield, said he has a chance to be better than he does. And I know this is lip service, and I wonder how much he actually believes that. Because Drew Brees, a guy who started his career as, not a bust, but he didn't fit in San Diego, and they moved on from him and ultimately got replaced by Phillip Rivers, and he had to resurrect his career to an extent in New Orleans. But Drew Brees has set records for passing yards. I wish I had the stats in front of me. I was trying to find it real quickly, but I couldn't dig them up. His 5,000 yard passing seasons is something to behold. I mean, it's not as if all those same teams were horrible, but I mean, he's got, I think, four, maybe five 5,000 yard seasons. There was a point in the National Football League, I feel like when I first came in, that if you threw for 3,500 yards, you had a successful season. Here it is. I have in front of me. 48. So starting in 2006, when he gets to New Orleans, 4,400 yards, 4,400 yards, 5,000 yards, 4,300, basically 4,400, 4,600 yards, 5,400 yards, 5,100 yards, 5,100 yards, 5,000 yards, 48, 52. And last year was a step back because they didn't need him to throw the ball. Drew Brees is one of the most accomplished throwers in the history of the National Football League. How in the heck is Baker Mayfield going to be? How could he even think of comparing Baker Mayfield to him? Now, maybe in terms of success, if the Browns build around Baker Mayfield, their number one overall pick from last year, the success of the Browns and Baker could be greater than Drew Brees' success. Obviously, they had the one championship, but in a couple of seasons that were sub 500. But I mean, I hear you, Drew Brees, trying to pump up the young kid. You like him. There's similarities that we want to draw because of size and maybe attitude and throwing acumen. But I mean, that's premature. I gotta wait like maybe a decade. Drew Brees has been playing for 18 years. I gotta wait a decade before you even start having that conversation that they're compared or comparable to each other. So the Triple G Canelo fight is interesting. We all remember what happened in fight one. It was such a hyped fight. Sal Canelo Alvarez versus Gennady Golovkin. Nobody wants to say his real name. They always say Triple G.
Triple G.
I tried to find it everywhere. I'm like, how do you say his? How do you pronounce his first name?
It's why people don't call you a Team Kiambu.
But Tiki's easy. It's a team. It's simple. Like, I play for a team. It's the same thing.
Yeah, but you know what? It throws a whole monkey wrench into that old saying. There's no I in a team.
But I mean, when I'm talking about a guy and I'm going to introduce a segment about a guy, I kind of want to say his actual name. And I was looking for it online. It was like, all right, somebody say his name. Everybody, Triple G, Triple G, Triple G. Someone finally said Gennady. So Gennady Golovkin, Triple G versus Alvarez. The first one was so hyped up. All four belts were on the line because Triple G owns them. And it was actually a phenomenal fight. It was worth getting on pay-per-view. And as it came to an end, I remember watching this. It comes to an end, and you're thinking, I mean, this either way, it's going. In my eyes, I see Triple G. I think Triple G won this fight. I feel like, you know, he was more aggressive. He landed more punches than Alvarez. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I liked Triple G. And even if I was wrong, who cares? Right, if Alvarez won, great, whatever. Somebody should have won, right? But no, we get a draw, right? We get a draw. Two of the scorecards were
relatively close. One was 114, 114, 114. One was 115, 113. And then the third scorecard was grossly in favor of Alvarez, which made it feel like I'm having the wool pulled over my eyes. Like some you're fooling me because of the scoring. And I get that boxing is subjective. I get that it's three supposedly independent judges watching a fight, and they all have their interpretation of what happened. And I guess that's the risk you take, or the risk you have to accept for the subjective nature of scoring in boxing. But as I left, as I stopped watching that fight, the only thing that I could think of is this is utter BS, right? This, it almost felt like it was fake, like they were just setting me up for the rematch, right? One guy couldn't lose, so let's make it a draw, and we'll have a rematch, and then we'll get more money. And so now here we are, just under a year. I think officially it will be a 365 days tomorrow, or maybe on Saturday later. We're going to see the rematch of Triple G and Canelo, and guess what they want us to pay for it? $85. Not a ton of money, but maybe it is in certain parts of this country or certain socioeconomic areas. And I'm telling you, don't fall for it. This is the problem with boxing. This is why it's fallen off the radar. This is why when mixed martial arts and the UFC and Bellator and these other like real fighting, you know, physical, you know, I'm trying to choke you out. I'm submitting you out. Competitions come to play. You choose it, right? Boxing has developed this stigma that it's not real. That no matter what we see with our naked eyes, no matter what we think we believe, somebody else makes a determination that doesn't line up with it. And that's why boxing has suffered. I think there's great fighters in boxing now. You see them everywhere. I got a chance to meet Deontay Wilder a few months ago when I was down in Alabama for Culture City's event, an autism organization that I talk about often and that we work with. And he was our guest of honor. And he's big and he's skinny and lean and this just amazing champion. He spoke so eloquently about his journey and how his daughter, who was born with a defect that he had to work through, they had to work through, but it was the reason why he was so motivated to be great. And then you watch his fights and they end. Like, he knocks guys out. But when boxing gets reduced to three individuals, three judges to make a determination that doesn't line up all the time, it's frustrating. And so I look at boxing and I can't trust it. Unless there's a knockout, I can't trust it. And you don't see knockouts in the middleweight and lower divisions. That's why I don't watch boxing anymore. I just don't believe in the result anymore. Samter, what are you trying to add?
Well, I mean, I agree with you 100%. And this is why I've been so bullish on the UFC.
Yes.
And I know the
Well, that
the
was my point. Because it ends and you can see it.
And that's,
right?
that's part of it. It ends and it feels like the refs, it's a little bit more... it's more transparent. Dana White is a little bit more open. Mm-hmm. So like if there's an issue with the decision, he'll come out and he'll question the judges also.
You're right.
But that's part of it. It feels a little bit more legitimate. There's more knockouts for sure. It's only five rounds instead of 12. So it's easier to see what's actually happening as opposed to 12 rounds and one round this, one round.
It gets lost, right?
Exactly.
What happened in round two gets lost by the time you get to round eight.
Correct. But the other part of it also is, obviously, the UFC is struggling right now with some of its stars, but when you go and you see a main event for the UFC, there's like four or five big fights.
Yes.
Two or three championship fights. You know all the fighters, right? You'll see, you know, Mighty Mouse in one
so
bout.
Even if you don't care
Chris
about
Weidman
one,
in another.
Even if you don't care about one, you care about certainly another one.
So if you're paying $99 for the pay-per-view, you're seeing four or five really good fights.
Yes.
Right? And maybe you don't care about fight number three, but you care about fights number two and four,
yeah,
or whatever it is. And even with this McGregor Khabib fight that's coming up here in a few months.
Nurmagomedov.
Everyone's going to be interested in that fight.
Of course.
But even if that fight is a dud, even if it goes four rounds, five rounds, and it's just a dud. There's four of the fights that you're going to be interested in watching. Now, if you pay $85 to see Triple G and Canelo,
yeah.
And there's no one watches the undercards.
Yeah, and look, there will be an undercard, and I'm sure it's some up-and-comer, someone that's interesting, but again,
I'm not watching it.
I'm not either.
And I've sure as hell never heard of any of those guys, most likely.
And I'm not watching Triple G Canelo, to be honest. I'll listen for the result now because I don't trust the result anymore. And it's frustrating because I want to. Like, I'm an advocate for bringing back that old-school boxing, right? That when I was young, and not young, but younger, and Mike Tyson was rising, and the heavyweights that we used to always see, they were still, you know, viable and prominent in the business. I wanted to see them. I wanted to. I cared about, you know, an aging Sugar Ray. I cared about those things. I can't make myself care anymore because I don't trust what I'm seeing.
And the other part of it also is the best fighters duck each other because they're more concerned about their payday than they are about fighting.
Yes.
Back in the day, you know, when you had like Ali versus Frazier and Foreman, I mean, these were big monster fights. You saw the best fighters fighting each other, and that's why it was so great. That's why it rose to prominence.
Yeah.
Now you see Mayweather ducking Pacquiao for 10 years and finally fighting him when they're both in their like 40s. Then you see Mayweather fighting Canelo when he was like 23 years old.
You're right.
And he was barely like ready to really step into that limelight. And now Triple G's got to be, you know, what is he, 36?
Yeah, he's older. Yeah, he's 36, right? Or 37.
So,
you're right.
So at this point, I mean, you're seeing all these fights after you want to see the fights actually happen.
Yeah,
I want to see the best fighters fight the best fighters when they're at their peak and at their prime, and the fight's actually going to be
good. And that's the difference with the UFC as well, or mixed martial arts fighting. They fight each other. And if they lose, who cares? It doesn't knock you out of an opportunity to be champion. It doesn't make you less of a champion if you have two or three losses on your resume, because that it feels real, right? You got to knock me out. You got to submit me. And so, I mean, the only thing that I worry about with UFC, the only thing, and I've talked about this a couple of times, the only thing I worry about is that Dana White is trying a little bit too hard to make it about the hype game, to gas guys up, and you disrespect champions like Cormier after he won. And right into the ring and challenging him again, and I forget who he's fighting. Brock Lesnar is in the ring and he's disparaging him, and it's like, I mean, that's it felt like WWE, to be honest with you. It felt like a WWE post championship hype for the next one to come up, and it struck me as wrong. Daniel Cormier had been through a lot. Obviously, he fought John Jones, lost to John Jones. John Jones was cheating, got stripped. Daniel Cormier gets back and after a career which felt like it was over because he couldn't beat John Jones, and here he is winning the championship or heavyweight championship in a different division. And being disrespected because it's good for hype. I didn't love that. It just felt disrespectful. So the one caution for the UFC is don't go there. The fighting takes care of itself, right? It stands alone, if that makes sense.
Although, to be devil's advocate, which I never do.
Yeah.
I never do that.
You're never devil's advocate.
But if you really think about how boxing, part of how boxing really got to where it got to, it was Ali, Bumbaye, Ali doing his hype game, it was Don King, the hype
true,
game.
True, but they would fight each other. You know what I mean?
Sure.
In boxing. They would.
But the thing is, so this is before we really knew, so it felt like it was real. It felt like these, you know, hype fights before the fight were real. But it may have been all just BS, and we just weren't smart enough as consumers to understand it yet.
Yeah.
But like Don King, Ali, they hyped it up in a way that Dana White and the UFC is kind of trying to do, but we've seen it before with the WWE, so we're a little bit smarter now than we were 50 years ago.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And look, the UFC needs stars. That's why Conor is coming back and fighting Khabib. I can't even attempt to say his last name. I never get it
Nurma
right.
Nurmagomedov.
He's gonna fight. They're gonna fight. When is that fight? Do we know? I don't know when it is, but But they need him, right? The UFC has a great opportunity to expand on what they've already built, but they need stars. And Conor's a star. Mighty Mouse is a star. But there's not a ton of them. There really aren't a ton of them. When is it?
October 6th. So three and a half
weeks. It's coming quick. That's actually quicker than I thought it was. I thought it was later in the year, even maybe next year. But anyways, Triple G Canelo is this weekend. I'm not going to be fooled enough to buy it, especially after I was fooled to buy the first one and got it's unsatisfied. That's really what it was. It was hyped up so much, and we talked about it so much, and then I left feeling unsatisfied. Tamta knows that feeling well. We are going to talk about Thursday night football. Game tonight. God, season, once it gets on you, these games really happen quickly. The Bengals or the Ravens? Big games. Are we buying either one of them from week one? We'll get to it. Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.